Good morning, everybody. I hope you got yourself ready. You put on your fire retardant suit for the dumpster fire at times that is the text of Judges, or it's Jared. We haven't really figured out which of those two things is the most accurate representation.
Both favorites.
Yeah. We've got some great sections of a powerful story of God's people to open up for our study. And we're going to shift a little bit because we are shifting off of the context of the military side. And we're moving in with chapter 2, verse 6 and following, verse 7 and following, into some of the what we consider religious or spiritual failures that take place. There's different terms we might use. We're going to try to also include some great opportunities for everyone who's participating virtually to ask some questions, to ask Jared and I some things. It's nice to see that Jared is wearing a collared shirt today.
I mean, let's be honest. It's a T-shirt underneath, okay? And I'm wearing gym shorts, but, you know, we're going to go with it.
Yeah, we're doing our very best with what we have. my hair is gradually turning into old man Logan, it feels like. We'll see if that adventure continues. But let's go ahead and actually get right into two things that are important for right now. Thing number one is where we've been, and thing number two is where we're going. And so Edwin had asked us, what did he miss last time? Because he wasn't able to be with our Bible study on Wednesday night. I think Jared's quick answer is, everyone messes up and sins, and it's not good. Thus they begin the anti-Joshua conquest narrative. It's the conquest that wasn't. Is kind of Judges chapter 1, verse 1. There are some other aspects of this text that are also important for us to consider as well, kind of how these things layer themselves out. If you look where we're specifically at in Judges chapter 2, verse 6 and following, which we'll read from as well, you kind of see a lot of this play out. So, Jared, what else do we have going on? This is kind of like, again, where we are, where we're going, and then we're going to get into the text.
Yeah, so we're still in the kind of what we would consider a prologue for the book of Judges here. And that's really cool because Judges is the only Old Testament narrative book that has a real prologue. Prologues in general are pretty rare if we think about it in the modern sense. The Judges has this prologue body epilogue. It makes it a lot of fun to read. So we've just covered, last time, like you mentioned, the military failure, and we're going to go into the spiritual failure here, and it's going to tell the same story in a very different way, and that's pretty neat. It's pretty exciting.
Right. So I want to include this. Last time, both on Sunday and on Wednesday, we discussed the funnel structure as we're now trademarking it. It's a trademark entity. Royalties will be, certainly.
Money's going to come rolling in.
Rolling in.
I'll get to retire soon.
Yeah, I'll be able to buy an Apple Watch. And that's probably, you have a reach goal of that. My reach goal is even more reasonable, but none of them are realistic. Those things are actually going to happen. But we've got the funnel structure here, and really, there's a couple of key elements. It's a reiteration of the ring structure, but it shows the spiritual progression of Israel. It shows how the various literary planning of God shows how these stories interact with one another, how they're kind of not so much like echoes of each other, but they kind of are. They're two sides of the same coin. When you flip the coin, it gets, different outcomes, but you still have basically a lot of similarities. So the color coding shows the similarities there. But there's another one that we wanted to show as well for this study this morning is a familiar approach for many to seeing Judges in another way. And so we're going to bring that up real quick. And this is another way to imagine the challenges that take place in Judges. And so, Jared, why don't you walk us through the classic cycle of sin in Judges? It's up there for those on the feeds and the streams to see, but we'll talk our way through it real quick.
Yeah, so this is the kind of the structure that a lot of us are used to when we read Judges, right? This is probably the one you've heard of and we've used when we've taught the book in Bible class before. It's a lot, have kind of filtered down a lot more than Kenneth Way's ring structure. And that's because it's really obvious when you study the book of Judges. It's put together right here, especially when we get into Judges 2 verses 13 through kind of 19. Where we see that at the beginning, it looks like Israel serving the Lord. Of course, we know that's a little bit of icing on the cake sort of a approach. But almost immediately, Israel fails. They fall into sin. They worship idols and they're not repentant. And God's like, okay, well, then I'm going to bring in a foreign nation. I'm going to enslave you to one of these other nations of Canaan. The ones you should have driven out, or someone that I've brought in, like the Philistines, just for this purpose. And when you are suffering, it's then you're going to cry out to the Lord. It's then you're going to complain. It's then you're going to focus on me. And I'm going to raise up a judge, and I'm going to save you. And I'm going to deliver you from this destruction. And we get a period of peace where we think Israel is going to serve the Lord. But it all just starts over and over and over again. And we could really put this in a spiral as well, because Judges is explicit here in chapter 2 that they just do worse than before in chapter 2:19.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty big deal.
All right. So also at this point, one of the things that I try to do in the physical Bible classes we've done at Eastside is to present the text in a way that helps us understand its recipient's setting. And so I say, picture a grandpa on the riverbank telling his grandkid about the story of Israel. And a lot of the text from really kind of Exodus forward all the way through the not so much the prophets, but the historical books as we kind of refer to them, can be read well with that kind of mindset. Like, here's a story. Grandson, sit down and let me tell you about Israel in the old days. And so the introduction, the prologue to Judges serves as an introduction of that. Here's the next story I'm going to tell you. And while you're away, here's some things that happened that I want you to remember again. And so that's kind of the prologue context. It's like, here's some stuff. This is all stuff you need to know. And maybe I've told you the story before, and maybe you've forgotten it because I forget everything. And here it is again. And so what we're going to see here is the second phase of those two things, both the military side and then the religious side or the spiritual side or the priestly side unfold, because you were away getting a sandwich in the kitchen is a way to think about this.
Go ahead.
No, I'm good.
I was going to say, another way to remember this is that, you know, we are so used to having our Bibles in front of us and being able to reference it anytime you want. Well, back then, most people didn't read, and almost nobody had a text of the Bible that they'd hear these stories, you know, at the major festivals when the people read them aloud. And so if you're going to hear a story once, you need to have some retelling in there, otherwise you're going to forget it. So this is a way that they are going to emphasize and focus on that reading, that physical reading and oral hearing too, for since they can hear the story once a year or so at most, right? And really internalize it and go forward.
Hey, it's good to, like, a little side note, everyone who's joining on the new methods, we've got some additional participants that have joined on YouTube today. We've got some additional participants who are seeing us through a couple other mediums and platforms. Super awesome that you're here. I talked to a number of folks yesterday and the day before, kind of coaching them through the best ways to get to this. For those who are using YouTube, you're probably finding out that the video is much better, and we apologize. You have to see us much clearer now. But
that does seem like a problem.
It's like maybe that's an unintended negative outcome. But I'm glad that you're here. Again, if you got questions and you type them in the chat, we can get to them in the course of the class. We love those. It makes the study much better, and we're trying to pretend that we're all in the same room. I don't know how well it's working, but that's at least the goal. So with all of that, with these couple different ways that we can think of the text here, that we can think of the setting of Judges and everything that's going on there, we now move to the text itself, because one of the most important parts of Bible study is the message, the Bible itself. And so when we pick up in verse 6 of chapter 2, we begin to see a couple of things. Now, chapter 1, verse 1, how did Judges begin? What's the first line, if you will?
Yeah, the Joshua is dead, right? And what's about to happen? I mean, this is the big question.
Yeah.
Is what's next? You know, what comes next? What's the end game here? To reference a popular movie, for what's about to happen.
Yeah. So I mean, like Joshua was dead, but then now verse 6, it kind of retells another story. It says when Joshua dismissed the people. Wait a minute, I thought Joshua was dead. And so it's the people of Israel went each to his inheritance to take possession of the land. So obviously the picture of the inspired writer of God has changed his focus from looking through the eyes of the participant to now he's telling the story from the third person perspective. And he's obviously looking back a little bit behind him on things that have happened. And so there's some important stuff that happens in this next dialogue, this next section of the text, that will help us understand why all these judges are super important. Aside from they do cool stuff, because they all kind of do some really visually, spiritually intriguing, awful, interesting, wonderful things. So there's some stuff that happens here. So what happens right here? You know, kind of getting right to the heart of it. What happens here in verse 6? And folks are following along. You have answers to this question too. Please give your answers to that question. Like, what's going to happen here?
You know, just shout them out at the TV, or your phone or your computer. We will, not hear you, but we're with you there in spirit.
Yeah. I wish we could. That'd be great.
It's like you're yelling at the TV, like the characters can hear you, right? You know, it's going to be the same thing going on here.
That's pretty much Judges, by the way. Like, we all know what's going to happen. So the first chunk, like say verses 6 through 10, what's the kernel of truth that you see there, Jerry? Like, this is the most important thing we need to know in these first introductory verses.
Yeah, so we have, again, the focus that people go and take possession of the land. Now, of course, we know from chapter 1 they don't do it right. But here, that's not the focus of what this is doing. Instead, it's trying to show that, listen, Joshua served God, and Joshua, to the best of his ability, made the people serve God. And those elders who had outlived him, who'd seen all the miracles that God had done for Israel, that leaves an imprint in their mind. But Joshua dies at the age of 110. Now, we can read this as just being a sort of a, hey, here's just a historical note, but I think there's something else going on here, because we've seen that Joshua's death and Moses' death are linked. Well, Moses, how old was Moses when he died, Philip?
Moses was 120 years old.
Moses was 120
years
old.
Literally also asked me that question while I'm fixing something with the stream, as always, but I'm always fixing stuff with the stream. I think there's a secret here.
But I pre-warned you this time. So Moses dies at 120, and that's kind of seen as sort of an ideal age. And so Joshua here, it's almost as good as Moses, but it's not quite. And he has no Joshua to take it up from him, right? And so this generation is gathered to their fathers, and we read, and there arose yet another generation who didn't know the Lord, and we've done for Israel.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. That's a real problem. You know, Edwin says that the kids ignore their parents' teaching and grow up to abandon the Lord. Yeah, and that's particularly scary when we realize that it's not like Joshua's generation was as faithful as we sometimes think. You know, they still got their Gibeons, they've still got their Joshua 24s, they've got their issues is there.
Yeah, Terry and Edwin make some great complimentary comments. Terry's comment here, one of Moses' greatest successes that he had a Joshua. One of Joshua's greatest failures was there's no successor for him.
Exactly.
A long time ago, and it was most refined with a comment of a friend of mine, Matthew Allen, not the one who preaches in Ohio, but Matt, who is a friend from Cookeville. And the day I joined the group of leaders that we were in, he said, and I saw you and I looked at you, what you could do. And I said, there's my replacement. Day one, he started having me do all the things that he was doing, even though he was still doing them. And his kid was older, my kid was younger, the timing was right, personalities were, complementary in that way. I don't think and this is a make an application of Judges moment, that's something we don't do well culturally. And I say we as humans, we don't do that well. We tend to hold power too long. Many of the evangelists I know struggle to let go of the lectern, let go of the pulpit, etc. That's a little side note, sidebar to back to this.
Yeah, I mean, definitely our culture teaches us that we should make ourselves indispensable. And I think that if we understand God's plan, it's kind of the opposite. We want to make ourselves dispensable, right? That Paul has his Timothys, and that's really important because there's a time coming around when there's not going to be a Paul.
Yeah.
So that is a really good point to bring up.
Right.
So, go ahead.
Back into the text.
Yeah.
What we've got right here is that there's also, like, in the military narrative, places, wars, things are more important. Like, where these things happened and who they were fighting with were much more important. I'm adding another person to the chat here for a second. And so I don't know if they'll come in, if they'll be able to hear them, but we're going to set all this stuff up. And so hopefully they can hear a Bible study. Thanks for joining on the other methods. I'm going to fix some technical stuff, and Jared's going to teach a little bit about the verse 11 and following.
So what we have in this, all couched in this military stuff that we've seen in chapter 1, is that we recognize that it's not really just a military failure, that these military failures are representative of spiritual failures, right? Because we see that the first thing that chapter 2, verse 11 brings up is the people of Israel do what's evil, and they start serving the Baals, right? This is exactly what Joshua says in Joshua chapter 24. Hey, choose now who you're going to serve. Are you going to serve the gods of Egypt like your fathers served? Are you going to serve the gods of Canaan like you're serving now, right? And he says, I'm going to serve the Lord, but you guys, y'all are going to have to decide for yourselves. And we see what they decided for themselves, right? They abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers who brought them out of Egypt. And instead, they start worshiping everybody else. And this makes God pretty upset. And we read right there in verse 14 that this is why he starts giving them over to the other peoples of the land. He sells them into the hand of their enemies. And this is not just a question of, well, Israel's not stronger than the Philistines. It's God says, I have empowered the Philistines against you. I've empowered these other guys against you. The way I was supposed to fight for you guys, I'm actually fighting for them. And this is exactly what I was warning you was going to happen. This is exactly what I was going to tell you was going to happen. Yeah. A text that we forget a lot of times is Amos chapter 9, verse 7 actually says God brought the Philistines into the land just to cause problems for Israel because they're serving other gods.
Right. And Jordan pointed something out, and we'll try to do this as we go forward, is to read through some of these sections of the text as we hit them so that they're on the top of our mind. I freely admit that my memory bank is often full and exceeding full. And so rereading it the first time helps me remember all the things. So as we go forward, let's go ahead and do that a little bit more with the text here. We can start here in verses 11 through 15, and I'll go ahead and read that chunk. We'll talk a little bit. We'll kind of chunk our way through for the next 25 minutes or so, because we do have a hard stop at 45, so I can get ready for Eastside's exaltation and worship service. So, verse 11, chapter 2. And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals or the Baals. And they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them and bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They abandoned the Lord who served the Baals or the Baals and the Ashtaroth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the hand of their surrounding enemies so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for harm, as the Lord had warned. And as the Lord had sworn to them, they were in terrible distress. Two side notes. Side note number one, that's not just the story of Judges. That's a story of Exodus to Josiah and beyond. And there's something to maybe learn from that smidgen of the detail there as how appropriate that passage is for then in the future.
Terry asks, could we explain briefly the Yeah, what does it mean here, the Baals? We have it in plural. So there is, Baal itself is kind of this term for master or other gods. It's kind of representative or parallel in some ways to Elohim. And the Baals and the Ashtaroth here are representative of all the different gods of Canaan, because a lot of the Canaanite peoples, now that's different from the Moabites and the Ammonites and the other kind of Abrahamic peoples, but all of the Canaanite peoples had their different version of Baal. So Baal Rimon or Baal Zaphnath. And so they're their own particular take, that they're mostly the same, but you just kind of put a different cover on them. And so here, when you have the plural, the Baals, it's just standard operating procedure for the gods of Canaan, plural.
Right. And so another, and there's some layers to think about it. You can think about it this way. Google Horus ruins Christmas and see how there's a false story attributed to a number of different gods as if it was true. And that's kind of how you can think of the Baals or the Baals, where they're all a kind of a classification of stories and gods rather than a unique god. And sometimes it's the unique god because you're only talking about one nation. Horus again. That's right. Horus is everywhere, Terry. Horus ruins Christmas. Did you put that in the chat? I hope you did.
I did just put it in the Facebook chat. I'm not sure if it'll go to everybody, but that is Lutheran Satire's Horus Ruins Christmas. Fantastic. Teaching the faith by making fun of stuff. I can get behind that.
Right. It's a really accurate historical take with comedy added to make it memorable. But that also tells a lot about how the way people treat some of this stuff. They will see Baal and think it's always the same thing. They will see that and not notice that, hey, like there's a plural here. You have hundreds of years between different nations, and they're both having the same deity terminology used. Some of it's language, some of it's otherwise. So there's some great stuff there. But that tells us a lot about what's going on, and the clearest tie to the text that I think is most important is the one that goes back to Joshua's statement, "As for me and my house." And the second one is what goes forward. He's foretelling the future, basically post-David. Solomon begins the slide. He's like the open door to Judges of the kings. And Josiah is the Ruth time frame to a degree. Not exactly, but it's rough. But that kind of shows us what takes place there in verses 11 through 15. Let's scooch forward. It's rapidly scrolling on your screen. I apologize for the folks who may have gotten some sort of flash response.
Whiplash, yeah.
But the next section of the text really goes all the way through chapter 2, verses 16 through verse 23. Jared, do you want to read that for everybody real quick?
Sure. Now, then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of those who plundered them. Yet they didn't listen to their judges. Instead, they whored after other gods. They bowed down to them. They soon turned aside from the way in which their fathers had walked, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord, and they didn't do so. Now, whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and he saved them from the hands of their enemies all the days of the life of the judge. Because the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning, because of those afflicted and oppressed them. But whenever the judge died, they turned back and were even more corrupt than their fathers, going after other gods, serving them, bowing down to them. They didn't drop any of their practices. They didn't drop their stubborn ways. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And he said, because this people have transgressed my covenant that I commanded them and their fathers, they have not obeyed my voice. I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations that Joshua left when he died. And he did this in order to test Israel by them, whether they will take care to walk in the way of the Lord as their fathers did or not. So the Lord left those nations, not driving them out quickly. And he did not give them into the hand of Joshua.
Yeah. So there's a lot that happens in the second phase, of chapter 2. But you notice again how there's a beginning point with Joshua and an ending point in the chapter with Joshua. It's kind of the book holders on a bookshelf. So Joshua is somehow important for us to understand this story. Like what's going on and what's part of that shift. Secondly, with Joshua being so important, and this being a spiritual narrative, not a physical narrative, what are some of the things we see about Joshua that was spiritually important to Israel? Like, how was he holding them in check, if you will, in comparison to other things? Just verse 19, stubborn ways. That's basically my nickname sometimes. And so this is an important question for all of us.
I mean, one thing we see throughout Israel's history is that Israel is never better than their leader. Now, they oftentimes are worse, right? I mean, just look at the people of Joshua's time. Look at the people of Moses' time. Look at the people of David's time or Josiah's time or Hezekiah's time. They're often worse than their leaders, but they are never better than their leaders. And that's pretty terrifying when we consider some of the leaders we're going to get here in the book of Judges. But just by Joshua's influence, he kind of acts as, I guess we would consider it in the New Testament, salt and light for Israel, right? Certainly David does, that God provides and remembers Judah because of David, right? Long after David is gone. Yeah. And so here, Joshua leaves, and they have a leader who's not as good as him, and the people just slide. There's no lowest common denominator, right? You don't have a peg that's keeping the people doing what they're supposed to do. And that's a real problem.
Yeah, there's no doubt there. And you could say any Israel is never better than their Israel, their leader, that is.
Mm-hmm. I knew what you were trying to say. Yeah. I got you. I'm picking up what you're putting down.
But in a broad context, that's always true. You look at a home. Look at a business, look at a nation, any nation, that's how it's going to be. We always want them to be better than they are. We always assume that we're better than we are. And Israel does all of those things too. They make all those same assumptions. You see that in their conflicts, their stresses, their strains, and all of that. So other practicalities in the text here. We talked about some of the stuff with the Baals or the Balls, depending if you're from Alabama or from Israel is how you're going to pronounce those two things. And if you're from both those places, you're just really confused. But in chapter 2, verses 16 through the end, what are some of the theological nuggets, some gold mining we can do here that's really important for us to pay attention to understand the rest of Judges?
I think one of the things that is really influential, and I think you've got this pulled up on Logos as well, if you go to Nehemiah chapter 9, verses 26 through 31, Nehemiah here in chapter 9 is retelling the story of Israel. And it's interesting, when he focuses on the period of the judges in verses 26 through 31, this is exactly what he picks up on, is the same cycle. You know, sometimes we wonder, hey, are you reading too much into the text to pick the structure? Well, I don't think so, because look at what Nehemiah says. Nevertheless, they were disobedient, and they rebelled against you and cast your law behind their back, and they killed your prophets who you'd warned them to turn back to you, and they committed great blasphemies. So you gave them into the hands of their enemies who made them to suffer. And the time of suffering, they cried out to you, and you heard them from heaven according to your great mercies. You gave them saviors, these judges, right, that we've talked about, who saved them from the hands of their enemies. But after they had rest, they did evil again before you, and you abandoned them to the hands of their enemies. So they had dominion over you, but they turned and cried to you, and you heard from heaven many times. You delivered them according to your mercies. And it continues on. It's pretty clear that Nehemiah is absolutely talking about the same cycle that we've put up in Judges. And Nehemiah here is extending that. He says, this is the story of us. This is the story of Israel. And he says, are we going to break the cycle? And I think that if we're honest, at least for me, looking at myself, if I'm honest, this is my cycle as well, right? That oftentimes I'm selfish or I serve myself, and it takes God really kind of knocking me around a little bit to remind me to go back to serving Him. And that, am I just like Israel? Am I, want to forget Him as soon as things go well,
yeah,
or not?
And certainly there's some present context we could think about that. I firmly have stated my conviction that post self-isolation phase, that Sunday worship is going to be the largest attended assembly for most churches everywhere. I think that's a fair bet. And then secondly, good luck finding a seat at a lunch restaurant on that day. I think they're all going to have the longest waits that we've ever had. Yep. But then next day, next week, next month, you know, my children, Jesse was born just before 9/11. And so I remember how united America was. And then I also remember how we gradually forgot that we've been at war ever since. I have friends who have spent their entire adulthood in physical conflict for the defense of their nations. And so I think there's some stubbornness in that level. Edwin comments, a stiff neck, stubborn shoulder. Everything always connects back to the epitome of idolatry and disobedience in Israel, Mount Sinai, and the golden calf. We become what we worship. And, you know, I've said that good theology grows in the garden, and bad theology might grow from the golden calf. You know, I think there's probably some good balances on both of those two things to kind of think about. What else do we have here in this part of the text before we kind of scoot forward to the last chunk that we have for us and then step back and play big picture game and look forward to the rest of it? So we got Judges chapter 3 and following just a little bit to close out this section.
I guess we see what's going to happen, right? God's going to test them. We know already the results of that exam are going to be, right? Because God tells us, right? The Lord left those nations, not driving them out quickly.
Yeah.
And we also know, because, you know, as we kind of suggested, that Judges is most likely or very possibly, however you want to think about that, kind of set up after Josiah's death, is we know what God's going to do to Israel in general. It's not just the people of Judges who failed. It's all of them who failed. And God's going to drive them out from the land. You thought it was bad when God didn't give all the nations in their land? What if when God brings in Babylon to really complete the conquest?
Yeah, I'll read verses 1 through 6. There's a couple of points in the specific text that I think are super interesting and valuable for the conversation.
Sure.
Now these are the nations that the Lord left to test Israel by them. That is, all in Israel who had not experienced all the wars in Canaan. It was only in order that the generations of the people of Israel might know war, to teach war to those who had not known it before. These are the nations, the five lords of the Philistines, and all the Canaanites, and the Sidonians and the Hivites, who lived in Mount Lebanon, from Mount Baal Hermon, or Baal Hermon, as far as Lebo Hamath. They were for the testing of Israel, to know whether Israel would obey the commandments of the Lord, which he had commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses. So the people of Israel lived among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. All the otherites. And their daughters they took to themselves for wives, and their own daughters they gave to their sons, and they served their gods. So hold up, wait a minute. I thought that the Israelites failed to push out the land. But the inspired writer is a little sarcasm here. The inspired writer is telling me that the Lord left those there. All right, which one's true?
Yes.
Can't we have both?
Exactly. Why not both? Why not both, right? That these are integrally related is that they would have been driven out if they'd obeyed God's commands. Their military failure is not a question of their martial skill. It's not just they didn't know war. Because remember what's happening at the beginning of Joshua, right? The people come into the land, they've never trained as soldiers. But they don't need to know war to march around and obey God's command. Hey, march around Jericho 7 times and then blow a trumpet, right? Like, this isn't like, hey, have you been, you know, training your spec ops, you know, sort of stuff. You know, are you a tactical preacher or something like that? It's, are you going to obey God? And if you will, everything's going to be fine. But they don't do either of that.
Hey, they're going to get their Ehud and their Shamgar. I mean,
exactly.
those guys exist in the text. They are important literary elements that God has used these souls to teach us truths. And so you got to have some of those as well.
Absolutely. But the focus here is, are you going to do what God says or not?
Yeah.
Because if not, you know, it's going to be a problem for them. And it is a problem for them, right?
Yeah. He uses them is part of the way in which the text shows us this setting. You didn't clean up a room? Okay, I'm going to tell a story here. a brilliant friend of mine. He was the same age as my older brother, David, and brilliant, just smarter than just most people. He was leaving to go to MIT on scholarship after he graduated high school, and he and a bunch of our friends went to clean out his room. And it was like an archaeological dig, because we started on his senior year and we ended up in kindergarten because his mom had just sealed off the room. Like, she had given up on forcing compliance to the cleaning. And he was a great guy, great kid. But, man, that was nasty. And she left it to teach him a lesson. He never learned the lesson. Israel was left these other nations to teach them lessons. They didn't learn the lessons very much either. But from our narrative standpoint, the way God writes the story, telling this generation that's hearing the message, this is what you need to know, this is what you've heard, this is what you've understood before, but this is what God actually said, this is the most powerful point of the text. This conclusion, you need to know this because this is the impact. They're here to teach you about failure and success. I think there's a lot that we need to pay attention to there. A couple quick comments. Terry noted, God left the nations because of their whoring. Edwin says this is an example of how God uses our own actions within his plans and how our actions influence God's plan. Bill and Cecilia said they didn't do so because God wasn't going to pick up their faithless slacking. I think that's probably a good point too. Terry cited back to Judges 2:21, which is a good point too. I think all of that catches the story that's about to push onto the scene. And there's some great stuff in the individual judges that we're going to see here. But before we get to them, let's pick all the pieces up and have a little bit of a look at what else is going on here.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is here when we mentioned in verse 3, the five lords, the Philistines, the Canaanites, Sidonians, Hivites, these are, if you kind of have your map in your head, and I know this is something, that these are north, south, east, and west of Israel. They're representative of all of the peoples.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, these are also the same nations that are focused in Assyria's invasion that comes at the time of Hezekiah, where Hezekiah also is kind of condemned for trusting in himself and his weapons rather than, you know, just praying to God, and then, you know, the destroyer comes in and wipes out the Assyrians. So we have those sorts of things that are playing out. In other words, this is meant to not just be random history that's included, but didactic and teaching us about this is how life works overall. But these tests, a lot of the times we think about God testing us as if he needs to find out the answer. But it's really to just show us what he already knows. You know, it's just revealing our character. Rather than like, God's like, I wonder if they're going to do all right today or not, you know, to help them understand that they need some problems, they need to fix some problems.
Yeah, an aspect of testing that is included in all the iterations in the Old Testament, New Testament, is not merely to try and see whether a thing is so. Periazo, New Testament Greek, that's all you just try, you're just testing it, see if you can do it. It's not just that, it's training. All tests are designed to quantify the results of training before or afterwards. And so that's why the texts generally have, we want to see how you do. They tested Abraham. Jesus is tested in his trials. Has nothing to do with his divinity. The testing there tests the devil. It tests us. It refines the work that Jesus is doing. He doesn't stop being God. He doesn't stop being who he is. But he goes through a trial, a test, to see where the things can go a certain way on our behalf. His test is more for us than it is for him in that mm-hmm. sense.
Will we say Christ is Lord, or will we say, give us Barabbas?
Yeah. You know, which father's son do we want? Which is another great illustration of God using literary stuff to teach us stuff. I think it's probably one of the best ones from that portion of the narrative, at least the easiest to grasp. With all this information, we kind of laid out some groundwork. When we go back into our upcoming sections of Judges, and right now we're looking back at the funnel, it's pulled back up. Each of these principles, whether it's failure of a military kind, where they didn't drive out a false god physically, or they didn't drive out a nation physically, are going to bring up some weeds. the garden wasn't properly cleaned. And remember, at least the way I see it, the Garden of Eden is the Garden of Canaan on that sense. And so they needed to tend their garden. If you want to kind of narrow the teaching of God to a simplified format. Alta's got a great question. We're going to close with her question in a second. I don't know if you can see it just yet, Jared. It'll pop up in a second. I can see the early feed. She says, are we being tested today? We got some possible ways to think through that one in a second. But all of those things are going to reappear in the rest of Judges. And so when we get to our next couple judges, which is going to be Othniel and Ehud, and I don't know if Shamgar will get his own separate episode, but I'm going to certainly push for his own separate episode. Probably.
I mean, we all know why you want to push for Shamgar's own episode.
He'll have some certain highlights. He will be the star of the show for as long as I can let it happen. So our question then, as we kind of close things out last 4 minutes, are we being tested today? I'm sure that's a question that many believers have. And so, Jared, we get to get 4 minutes to answer this, the most important question we've ever been asked. Because some ways it is. I mean, it's a today question. What's your hot take for today?
My hot take for today, we're always being tested, right? We may not know exactly why or exactly what, but every day of every moment of our lives, we have a question to say, are we going to allow Jesus to live as Lord in our hearts? Or are we going to serve ourselves? Are we going to do what the people at the end of Judges says and do what's right in our own eyes? Or are we going to serve God? And, you know, in moments like today where we're, you know, feeling maybe particularly tested, maybe we have friends or family or people we know who are suffering, it can feel very obvious that we are. And that's a good thing. That gives us an opportunity to say, okay, let me buckle down. Let me really focus on God. Let me focus on my prayer life. Let me focus on studying. Let me focus on serving. But I'd say we have to be careful that we don't just so much focus on these single moments that we forget the rest of our time. So yeah, I think we are being tested. And I think that's more obvious now maybe than it would be.
Yeah. Number one, the test is continuous. In the biggest sense. To get more specific in answering the question, is the current health crisis a test? I have no idea and as to how that's happening beyond a few key biblical tells, like things that God tells us. God tells us through the story of Job that the devil can interact with man. But God tells us also in the story of Job that God allows the devil to do that. From the garden, we know that things were one way and now they're not. And so everything is nastier post Adam and Eve's rejection of God's laws. And so with those two key theological truths, there are two possibilities that just using those two principles. Possible one, the devil's doing stuff. He does stuff. He doesn't like you or me following Jesus. And so he's still the roaring lion. Is he doing stuff? It's a possibility. I won't be able to answer that question until I'm on the other side with relative certainty. Is the world doing this stuff? Yes, it does this stuff. Viruses, some beneficial, some not beneficial. Bacteria, some beneficial, some not beneficial. All that happens too. Does man do stuff to himself? Well, yeah, that's too. So all those
things. We see that here in Judges.
Yeah. So all that's possible. We're still being tested. The same basic test exists. Do we follow God? That's all our time we have for this Bible study. We thankfully got most of it in this time. The plan is for Wednesday, should the Lord will, we'll be back in Judges chapter 3, picking up around verse 7, looking at two or three of the initial judges, Othniel and Ehud and Shamgar, will probably be what we talk about. We'll see how it goes. But right now, the live portion, if you're watching on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Periscope, Twitch, all those stuff, it's going to go dark for about 15 minutes, and then the feed will come back up at for our next part of the study, which is 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's going to be members of the Eastside Church of Christ, where I work and labor. We're going to have some time for Bible study. We're going to look at 1 Samuel and talk about David being a man after God's heart, and what does that mean, and how does that impact us as believers today. Right now, we got to go dark for a little bit, but thank you so much for being part of it, and have a fantastic day.